Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 357th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by wonderful patrons Cole Needham. Gonna send you a hat, Cole, and I'm very excited to do it. And Connor. Thanks, guys.
Today on the show, we have James Genn. He's an accomplished director with a pretty impressive list of credits. He's here to talk to us about directing on the show Ginny and Georgia. Boy, he's got a lot of stuff. He's got The Good Doctor. He did some episodes of The Hardy Boys, Moonshine, Turner and Hooch, Charmed, Private Eyes. The list goes on and on. He's got a ton of experience. We talk a lot about being the producing director as well as being a guest director on all sorts of different shows.
What does that mean? That he's directing episodes and also helping other directors direct their episodes.
Right. Essentially supervising the directors as a director himself, like a person who knows what the job entails and can kind of help guide the guest directors through the different specifics of the show that they're shooting.
Yeah. And I was shocked that even though he's Canadian, he is actually really nice.
Yeah. Crazy, right?
Unheard of.
No, really, really awesome. Really generous with his time. Yeah, you know, every once in a while on the show, like, you have a conversation with a director and you feel kind of like recalibrated afterwards. You're reminded why you love this, the good parts and the bad parts. You know, it's a really honest, frank conversation. I guess I'm saying I left a little inspired, Oren.
Yeah, me too. I kind of like, in an odd way, felt like he's one of the few guests that really treated us like we're also directors. Not that it matters, okay? You don't need to be treated like these directors.
It is nice, yeah. It's like, I think that there is that every once in a while, a director will come in and they won't realize we're directors. And then one of us will say something that will clue them in. Sometimes people just are like, just treat us like we're, you know, interns at a junket.
I think a lot of people that come on here are, you know, doing press tours for whatever project is being released at the time. So they are kind of being interviewed by a lot of media outlets and things. And so when they are lucky enough to be on the Just Shoot It podcast, they might think we're just like all the other ones until we ask them how they came up with that one weird shot. And then they fall in love with us. Anyhow. Talk about inside baseball. Well, we had this awesome talk with James. You know, he kind of illuminates what it's like shooting TV, what it's like shooting in Canada. You should check out his show, Ginny in Georgia. There's two seasons out on Netflix right now. And it's kind of a genre bending kind of story that works on multiple levels that I think is really easy to enjoy, no matter who you are, no matter how Canadian you are.
Before we hop into our conversation with James, I do want to remind listeners that if you go to patreon.com/justshootitpod, you can throw the show a couple bucks. We've got server fees. We've got advertising fees. We've got editors to pay.
Yeah, we just got so many fees. My taxes.
It's a surprise. Yeah, Oren's taxes, paying for his car lease on his third car. His kid's going to drive eventually. Who knows?
I need to drive a car that matches my outfit.
It keeps us going. Literally, we wouldn't be able to make the show without your patronage. So if you think that this episode or any of the episodes that you've ever listened to in your whole darn life gave you a little something, kept you inspired, kept you committed to the show, or that you learned something that you could apply in your practice, consider dropping us a buck or two.
My guess is that 90% of our listeners hit the fast forward 30 seconds right when we start talking about Patreon. But if you did not fast forward through this, you know what we should do? We should get some testimonials. If you ever learned anything on the show and then used it successfully, just record some audio, email it to us. We'll play it on the next Patreon pitch. Anyhow, email us. Tell us what you like about the show, what you hate about the show. We love to hear from you. Go to patreon.com/justshootitpod. If you give us $20, I will personally mail you a hat.
Without any further delay, except for maybe an ad or two, join us in our conversation with James Genn.
Okay, we are here with James Genn. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I apologize for asking you the question that you probably get from every person, but how is it being a director with a name that's so similar to another director?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually, there's crews in Vancouver that have worked with James Gunn, and I've been mistaken when people will come up and say, oh, I'm working on your show. And I say, no, I'm sorry, that's not me. So yeah, I kind of wish he would change his name, but he hasn't listened to me on that one yet.
I know. Well, he's kind of fading away. I don't think there's going to be much more coming out of that guy.
Fewer credits, certainly. Yeah. Yeah. His name's not going to be on anything coming up.
But obviously he's known for superhero movies and things, but you do a lot of genre stuff and kind of cross genre work. Like how would you define yourself as a director?
Oh my God. In terms of what I've chosen to do over the years.
Yeah. Or if someone was like, what kind of stuff do you direct? What's the answer?
How does your agent pitch you?
That's a really good question. It's always been eclectic, and I've always taken a lot of pride in being someone that could shift around and take on voices. And I always loved the challenge and the excitement of doing different things. So my career has kind of defied that, pegging myself into a single genre, and that's been a good thing. That might also be something to do with the advantage of being in Canada, where you get access to a different variety of things. There's less directors that are having to focus on a single genre or not. I started out in my TV directing career directing comedy. So that was, you guys have done comedy as well. That was such a great place to start and sort of cover so many things. And that it weirdly branched me out into things like procedural and did horror comedies, and that went into other genre stuff. So I had the luck of being able to mix it up and shift around.
Let's talk about that just a tiny bit more, because I think that's really interesting. Would you say that the horror comedies were maybe half steps into other worlds? You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to go from comedy to straight drama, but if you have a dramedy under your belt, then maybe they're like, well, James could be, just stop making jokes and he can do it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely with dramedy. So horror comedy, maybe not so much, but the horror comedy stuff I did earlier on was great because you learn all kinds of stuff about effects and VFX and special effects and doing gags and that kind of thing. But for me, where it evolved from was hour-long drama comedies, dramedy. So suddenly your work becomes a lot more dramatic overnight, really. And you get to exercise those muscles and stretch your legs in that world. So yeah, that was the bridge for me.
But don't you think dramedy is so much easier than comedy? Like,
it's for
because if a scene's not, if you're not getting laughs, then you're like, yeah, that's the drama part.
It was obviously it's forgiving. Now, I wasn't doing multicam sitcom style comedy. I was doing single camera half hour comedies for Canadian network TV when I started out in my early 30s, and that too also had drama elements to it, right?
So
That to me is the stepping stone.
And so now I feel like just looking at your credits, you have kind of a lot of action, drama, TV, a lot of, obviously some of the stuff you worked on is for Canadian markets, but a lot of it kind of feels like network, kind of big network TV shows, right? Like a Charmed, Hardy Boys.
The Good Doctor. Yeah.
The Good Doc, I'm just finishing up right now. It's my last day of editing on the episode I just finished. And there's one that I did in October that airs on Monday, actually. So that's fairly new in my life. But years ago, I did a medical drama. So again, I went from doing dramedies to procedural cop shows. And then I got hooked into a medical drama and worked as a producing director on that in Canada. So then years down the line, it comes up where I'm in Vancouver and Good Doctor is shooting, and the agents are able to pitch me for that. So,
and for our listeners, real quick, what do you mean by producing director? What's the difference between that and a director?
A regular guest director will come in and do an episode or a block of two episodes or three episodes. And a producing director will stay on and cover a whole bunch of other things that are along the lines of directorial work that isn't directing. So you'll be supporting the other directors along the way, working in post a lot.
So what's the difference between that and like show running?
Oh, well, show running these days is almost entirely from the writing department. So mm-hmm. there are show running producing directors out there that I've worked with, and it might be more of a Canadian thing. But show running is the top of the leadership pole in the television world. The producing directors are people handling production. It's a creative leadership role. So you're creatively in charge of the hundreds of people on set that are executing. I guess the easiest way to describe it is in show running, you're creating the stories from top to bottom and you're leading that. And the director is a storyteller. So a producing director is doing what they can in order to make things come alive and come about, right? You're not originating the ideas, but you're executing them as best you can.
And all the way through post, like you're looking at edits of other directors' episodes and things
like
that.
Yeah, that's right. And which that is a huge learning experience, just to see how other directors handle the same material. It's really amazing. It's the same for any kind of directing, but the job differs every time. It's a little different based on what the particular show needs.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How you can fit in and make yourself useful. I think even as a guest director, you kind of have to look at the situation, look at the play, see who's involved. What kind of leadership is the showrunner doing? What are the other executive producers on board? How are they met? How are they running the show? Who's in charge? Who's got the puck before you jump on the ice and start trying to score goals? You wait for the pass.
Right. I'll take your word for it. You know, it's funny. One of the reasons that Oren and I started making the show was that, you know, directors, there's only one director on set most of the time, right? And so one of the big advantages of getting to talk to an awesome director every week for years and years now is you get to kind of pick up all of their different little tricks and moves and, you know, learn from them, essentially, right? And I've always thought...
Which, feel free to drop as many tricks and moves as
but by all means, by all means, that's what we're here for. But never occurred to me that... as the directing producer, you also get to kind of absorb, you know, a handful of different people's tricks and moves and guide them, obviously, like you're there, but like you kind of get to pick up and learn from them as well. I always knew that that's an awesome job. Now I'm even more jealous. It's pretty cool.
There's so few chances that directors get to communicate with each other. That's what's amazing about your podcast. The most you get, I think, is those friendships, people you know who are also doing this job and they're loving it, right? You guys yourselves would probably get to share a lot of things. And there's very few times that somebody said to me one time on directors that directing is a very lonely job.
Sure.
And it's a funny thing about it, because you're surrounded by hundreds of people all day long and you're communicating with them. It's an extremely social job. You're the center of sort of a social community. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, when I was in high school or something, I wasn't the center of my social community at all. But in my job, I'm automatically that. You could step into any conversation on set and people are going to turn and let you in, even if you have some stupid thing to say, right?
Yeah, I find that most directors become directors because no one listened to them in high school.
That's pretty possible. Maybe that's the case with me.
Yeah.
But in producing, directing, yes, you get to the more experience I've had with this job is working on shows where other producing directors were already there, right? Mm-hmm. And so I saw the job done in a lot of different ways. So when I had the few chances that I've had to do it, I really set out to say, I know how to make this job really good and useful and do a good job. A lot of it, quite frankly, is pretty hands off. Mm-hmm. A director comes in. When I'm a director coming in on a show, I want to know that people have put their trust in me, right? They're going to support you. A really great show with a really experienced group of producers are going to know how to get the most out of their director, right? So it's different every time, but you look at it, how can you support that director and give them room to do what they need to do and give them confidence, right?
Can you give us some like more practical, like specifics? Like when you say the producers are supporting you or, you know, that you're supporting them, like, are they asking you for a shot list? Like what, like, are there some real specific things that, you say, I don't work with shot lists.
Sure. Yeah. And I'd love like the contrast between like, oh, like maybe a showrunner or team early in their career, like a little less experience. And then what's the difference between like someone who really knows how to get the best out of people and maybe gotcha. Some early mistakes?
You know, it's a personality thing. Sometimes in my experience, I've had situations where, you know, people bring all their own personalities to the job as a director, and they're going to bring that to the job as a producer, right? So if they feel like they need to be more involved than they are, then you have to figure out a way to manage that as a director, right? Mm-hmm. Same with the cast. You're going to get people that every actor that you encounter, you're assessing how do you react to that person to get the best work out of them? How do you support them, create an environment for them where they're going to give them the best work? So same should go for people's relationships with directors. And that can vary every time.
You're saying you need to know how to support actors, how to get the best performances out of these people, but I assume on TV, a lot of times, kind of like in commercials, you're probably not getting to spend a ton of time with the actors before you're directing your episode. Like, how do you learn, you know, oh, she likes, you know, no rehearsals and he, you know, wants like precision, you know, blocking.
Yeah, you learn that on the fly. A lot of times you learn the broad strokes in prep. In cases where, like for instance, in the opening weeks of the second season of Ginny and Georgia, the cast had not worked together since before the pandemic, but the second season was delayed because of the pandemic. So it's a cast that had worked very closely with each other, but they'd not had a lot of time with each other. So we did little warm-up rehearsals. We just hung out and got a chance for them to get back into the groove. And there was also a chance for me to see what they were like as people. Other times it will be a tone meeting. A great showrunner, a writer will say, here's what we found with this actor. This is something they really respond to. This is how they treat this material. And we like it like this, we like it like that. And that's really valuable information. But 95% of this is coming from just being in the zone on set, which you guys are familiar with. That is that's the awesome place. That the reason why we do this job is that amazing feeling you get where you're just grooving with people and you're seeing how they perform and you're watching their work and you're looking for very simple ways to elevate it every chance you get, right? And keep it on target with what your story you're telling.
I love your point though about, you said simple things that you can do to get the most out of somebody's performance, because I think that sometimes, you know, you think, oh, I want to have like kind of big swooping vast changes. I really want to move the iceberg on this one. And I think that, again, the more experience you get, the more you realize, like, oh, it's probably just like the teeny tiny things where you can take it from an A to an A plus, I think is what's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. I'm over 100 TV episodes down the road, and I did indie features and stuff like that. But I do recall when I started, I've been through every bad iteration of evolution of as a director along the way, right?
You had a scarf on once upon a time, is what you're saying, James.
One of those big cones, all that stuff. I remember a short film I did in my 20s where I really sat the actors down and I tried to make their words come out of their mouth precisely how I heard them in my head. And I felt that was the only
way.
And
it was a great short film. I'm sure it was perfect.
And yeah, it won Toronto.
And somehow they cooperated with it. But I learned very quickly that that wasn't the best way to get the best work out of people. The efficiency of communication to me is the name of the game. And also just it sounds so weird, but just creating the environment for them. I just a week and a half ago, I was working with I won't say the actor's name, but a really amazing, great senior actor. And we got into a few takes on her coverage, and she stopped and she said, I'm not getting it, or I'm not connecting, is the words she used. And this is someone who was a very technical actor, right? Somebody who, and I was there, I was new to them, and they needed a really engaged conversation with the scene. So all we did was say, okay, let's talk about this. And where were you before this happened with this character? What happened? You went out the door and you had that, and he would have said this, and he would have said that, and you would have learned this about him. And then that's how the conversation came in. And it, whether that was the right thing to say or not, it just set the scene and put the actor in a place of ease. And sometimes maybe I think in that moment, it was just about them knowing that I was watching and I was paying attention and looking for what was authentic and truthful and beautiful, because really when you're sitting in your monitor, that's what you're looking for. Right.
And it's easy for people to underestimate that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cause you're behind the monitor.
I think a lot of people are, you know, in television, there's all kinds of directors coming through, right? And there's at all levels of types of communicators. And I hear actors say all the time that this director was focused on shots, or this director was great at communicating about story and not so much the other thing, right? So they're, if you put yourself in their shoes, they're also trying to assess you and say, how can I work best with this person and get the best out of them as a director, right?
Yeah. I imagine there's this weird thing where as a TV director, you really want the actors to like you, you know? It's like very different than a feature film, like your indie film director, right?
Yeah.
That's like the actors want the director to like them so that they hire them again.
Yeah.
But on a TV show, it's like, I mean, I've heard many
power dynamics, basically.
Yeah. Right? And many stories of like a DP not coming back for the second season because one of the actors didn't like them, you know, like that's a super common thing where the cast. As a director, if you feel like you kind of like bummed an actor out or said something that like rubbed someone the wrong way, you probably feel like you need to
make up for it.
Yeah. To make up with them somehow. Right. I would think.
It happens all the time. It happens constantly. It happens every day. You're going to do that and you're going to say the wrong thing and you're going to say the right thing. Some directors, in my understanding and my experience, are not like that. They care less about it and they still have other charm or personality about them that earns their respect in the group. But you are a guest, right? Mm-hmm. You're seeing what the culture is there and you're trying to make yourself as valuable and as useful as you can in that culture. And that's what's going to get you the best work, I think. Also, though, there's a really important milestone that you should look forward to in your career is when you stop worrying too much about what people's impression of you as a person is on a moment-to-moment basis when you're in that zone on set. It's it's about trying to focus and put the work you're making with that person as a priority and put that first, right? So, to me, that's what's going to automatically give you a strong relationship with people, because they're going to see that you've built a collaboration with them.
Yeah. So you're saying that basically, if you get over yourself and focus on the work, people will like you more for it, kind of, right? Yeah.
I don't. And I do, as a person, I'm not a bossy person as by nature. I'm not a person that feels like they need to be in charge all the time. When I first started out in directing television, I relied entirely on my prep. So mm-hmm. I prepped the hell out of my work and knew the material inside and out so that I could think spontaneously and think intuitively about the questions that were flying at me. I still do that, but I'm able to relax more. But
what's like some prep that you used to do that you've kind of come to realize is like not as important, or like you're kind of more, it's more of a feeling now than like you've written down five different ways to say this line of dialogue or whatever.
Okay. Well, there's that one thing is that I don't write, I wouldn't note on ways that things are performed by the actors as much. Contrary to what I just said, there's certainly habits that I've carried through my first days of directing that I do almost ritualistically. Like, for example, I will storyboard out the entire show. It doesn't matter if it's a two shot of whatever, mm-hmm. close-ups over the shoulders. I sit down as the...
And you draw every over the shoulder every time you're going to cut back to it.
With crap. Well, no. I have a system for doing it in terms of which shots we do. So, so I've worked out how to most efficiently, you know, where the cameras are going to be placed and how I would do it technically. Also, coming from the Canadian system, we started out, and in comedies especially, we start out with very low budget television. So it's really all about efficiency. And I think over the years, I've really benefited from that training because to me, that's often what gives you the best results. You're forced to sit down. And the reason why I draw all this stuff out is because I've gone through the process of having to decide what five ways a scene could be shot technically. So when you're on set, I'm able to ignore that and know what I'm going to gain and what I'm going to lose when things inevitably change. So the big evolution over the years has been, even though I go through that process of drawing things out technically very carefully, I am really able to let it go when I go to shoot and just let it invent itself a little bit, let the actors make some calls.
Do you share those boards that you draw with like the cinematographer, mm-hmm. producer, AD, or are they just in your head?
Is it just behind the scenes?
Yeah, I guess you would want to, if you want to let the actors play a little, I'm assuming you'd light it maybe in a more freeing way, right?
I'll say this, I'm prepping a job right now with a DP that I love and have worked with for years and years and years. And I screen shared my document with him today and we were like going through a shot list or whatever. And I was like, I could tell from the Google Doc he wasn't in there. And I was like, hey man, you want to jump in and make the note here? And he was like, I'm going to be honest, that doc doesn't make any sense to me at all.
It's like the beautiful mind.
That's why I don't share. The answer for me is, and I've asked this question a lot, is no, I don't. Like 95% of the stuff is just for my own process and my drawings are not for sharing and my drawings are crappy enough. They're not for anyone else. But there's that every show has a action sequence, a visual effects sequence, maybe a complicated multi-character blocking situation where an overhead is useful, or you're on a exterior location where it's really important where the sun is going to be and where the trucks are going to be and all that stuff. So you would overhead map it out. So during the process of prep, when I go through in that pass, I go through the script chronologically as if I'm visually building and telling the story. When I reach those places where I know, oh, this is something that a piece of my excellent iPad artwork is going to come in handy, then I'll draw it out more carefully and I'll color it in and I'll use, you know, green for graph and all that stuff. So
do you use like a stylus?
Yeah.
Are you like iPad Pro, like the whole setup?
Yeah, iPad Pro. So I for years I did it in a binder with the same setup of 16:9 frames or whatever your aspect is, and then the right side of the page is an overhead and the left side of the page mm-hmm. is five frames. And then I start by saying, what's the sort of what things do I want to anchor this scene by? It's if this beat wants to play in this style of a 50-50 two shot or something like that, then I can work out the dynamics of how to efficiently, you know, set up a scene.
Do you kind of figure out like the heart of the beat of the scene, like this scene is about this, this is the most important beat, this is how I would like to see this, and then kind of work backwards to create the rest of the shots based on that?
Depending on the scene, yeah, that's often what will happen. Yeah. So it's scene by scene specific, and it's not the first pass that you've done on the script. Like you've done a pass where you're just reading it. I've done a pass where I literally write out almost like those AD slug lines so that you know what, if you had to write it in 10 words or less on a single line on a Word document, what that scene is about. And then I will have made notes all the way through the script. And then I go through that process of trying to technically turn it into interesting stuff. And
I love that. And so is the slug line, I imagine, has kind of maybe two effects. One is you can kind of succinctly, you have a shorthand for what the scene is quote unquote about, but that also probably forces you to distill down what is the most important to the scene and therefore informs that first shot that you want to kind of build the scene around.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's also, I also think that the whole process of that prep is also really just about memorizing it. It's like memorizing it and internalizing it and getting a feel for it. Because again, it's about getting yourself into that place when you're on set where you're just in this intuitive mode and you can just be free about it. Like that's where I get the most joy in shooting. It's rare nowadays. Like there are times when I started out where, you know, I'd go into some giant thing or some scary thing and I'd be freaking out. Like I'd be really nervous about it. And so that prep takes that away. I know that I have a plan. It's going to get mutilated and changed and things are going to get ruined, but I know what I'm going to lose and gain.
I'm curious, when you have like an action scene or something that's not a dialogue scene, basically, like, how do you approach that the same way? Do you say like, oh, when they fall off the building, this is like the main shot, you know, and kind of work backwards to get there? Or do you think about like camera, like the motion, the camera, or like hand, like, are you starting with like, this is going to be handheld versus dolly versus techno crane? Like, how do you go into like an action scene?
Firstly, those types of things are like so fun, right? It's like essential visual storytelling. It's like, it's so great. I saw some of your commercials on your site too, and you guys get it. It's like, it's just really fun to tell stories visually. So yeah, I break it down in more or less the same way. It's like there's a sequence. You just read a page and you're like, oh my God, how am I going to get through this? How do I start opening this thing up and breaking it down? You say, okay, well, there's this image of a thing flying out of an airplane. The coolest way to see that would be like this. And then after a while, you kind of develop this bucket of your favorite ways to visualize something. And you dig it up and you mix it up and you spit it out again, right? So it's true that, you know, when I've there's people walking into a room, take for example, like there's 1,000 scenes you'll shoot of two people, somebody steps into a room and finds somebody else, right? There's a dozen different ways that different directors are going to have that little moment happen, like what just happened in the background of your right?
and
good. Is that right? Yeah, perfect timing. So you can, how are you going to do that? Are you going to reveal the person from the first person's point of view? Are you going to be inside of the room from this person's point of view and have them enter in? Are you going to disguise information from the audience? There's just all sorts of fun little tools that we get to use as directors to tell a story that most people don't even recognize that we're able to do. And some people just do it. Some people just go for it. I happen to be someone that likes to sort of think it through. A lot of times those decisions come up based on what other things have already happened in the show or happen nearby in the show, or you know, so you're not either repeating yourself or you know, something like that, which is a very common reason you're going to make these decisions. Again, another reason why you'd start chronologically and play the movie in your head and draw out a way that it can happen.
And since you're like a producing director on a lot, you know, like on Ginny and Georgia and some of these other shows, do you start out being like, okay, this would be the coolest shot. Like when this thing falls out of the airplane, we're going to, you know, put a camera on a skydiver and follow it, you know, out. And then we're going to do this. And then when it lands in the ocean, we'll do like this drone shot. And then when like, do you start with the coolest shots and then figure out how to get them? Or do you think more like, okay, we're going to have the crane on that day and the dolly. Hours of sunlight. So what, how can I use those tools and what kind of shots can I get with those tools? Like how much are you worrying about production versus vision?
It's an awesome question. And it's probably a combination of the both. It's an awesome question with no easy answer. And it depends entirely on the project, the day. So you're always trying to fit your material into the resources you have in some way or another. Some cases, it's all about the resources. And a lot of the Canadian television that I began making, it was, you know, what is the most efficient way? How do we actually hide what we're doing and cheat it so it looks bigger than it is? As I've built into these bigger shows with the American money behind them, then sometimes you think that there's some of the things you're doing, there's very little limit. Does it start one way or another? Like, I think you can do things like you say, I really want to see this shot happen. And you can say, well, I can make that happen. And then there comes the, how do you make it? Okay, that is a techno crane shot, whatever it is. Right? So you get to mix it up. There's a doggy in your house now.
I'm curious, you know, in talking about like your brainstorming process and the way that you break through or break down each scene, you know, like those different sparks, right, that get you excited about a scene or crack it open for you. I imagine that has become kind of just part of your process. But as a supervising director or producing director, I should say, you're not literally directing every episode that you're working on, right?
No.
And so, like, how does it work when you're not directing?
Right.
You know, you have an awesome idea. You're like, it would be really cool if you know, you use the techno crane or you know, have somebody jump out of the plane to follow.
Yeah, I just put a cable cam on hold for you just in case you think that would be helpful.
Like, because it's tricky, right? Because it is, it's your call, right? If you're like, hey, this is the best way to shoot this scene, it's kind of your job to be able to, you know, you can put your foot down and say that, but also you want to get the best out of your directors. So walk us through that a little bit. That's really fascinating.
I mean, it's come up a few times, but the majority of my experience has been as that guest director side of things. And I just appreciated the attitude of the producing director when I worked with them, that they were there to support it, right? Support the plan. Gotcha. So I approached the job that way as well. And I had very little influence on what the directors, in my experience doing it, what the other
But for sure you've been in scenarios where like a director comes in, maybe they're an actor turned director or someone that like comes from maybe like a less like camera technical side of things. They have amazing ideas on performance and tone and music and all this stuff, but they just want to cover the scene in the most boring way possible.
They're like, you look at their shot list and you're like, oh, got it. A two shot and two overs.
We don't share shot lists really, maybe because for this very reason, but also the DPs are there to support that discussion.
Sure. Sure.
I can give you examples though. Like, a director saying, I want to do something special for this particular shot at the end of the episode. And I'll say, oh, we can make sure this happens for you. And then they take it off and they take away and they riff how that shot's going to happen. We provide it and they go for it. Yeah. So my best experiences with producing directors has been where there's very little interaction. There's support. One of the biggest supports you get is the rundown on how the cast is how the cast mm-hmm. is to work with.
Who, right. Do not look him in the eyes.
Yeah, that stuff is so valuable. It's like shorthand. You can, it yeah. takes you miles. Also crew and you know, what's things to watch out for. But when it came to how you're going to approach things, that your best guide is going to be the script itself, how you visualize it and interpret it. And if the show has done other episodes, of course, that you've seen other directors do on it, right? But the directors all stay consistent to the material because mm-hmm. the material itself is consistent, right? There's very little change. I will say, though, the first time I did the producing director job, I recall I had a hand in the when we were picking the other directors. It was 22 episodes. So there's a whole lot of directors. And some of them I remember thinking, oh, my God, I love this guy's work. His indie feature film is stellar. It's so interestingly shot. It's different. And so we bring that person in and you apply that to a fairly to a regular audience, a fairly standardly shot television model. And that their work was delivered the basics of what, as if they looked at previous episodes and say, okay, what I need to do to get through this is shoot it like this. So it looks exactly like this show.
You're saying like they've got the goods, but they're holding back, they're pulling punches because they think that's what you want.
It feels that way, as if I guess the positive way to look at this is that the directors that I thought really were awesome were ones that threw that away and sort of said, how do I do something mm-hmm. awesome in every little scene? How can I make this interesting right. for myself? How do I elevate it? And they would put interesting shots in there that told the story. It's the matter of you have a framework and the script is determining what you can't stray outside of the lines of the tennis court, right? Your mm-hmm. your swing can be awesome and your serve can be awesome, but you don't, as long as you stay in those lines, you're doing great. It's not challenging yourself to elevate it that I saw as one of the biggest errors that new directors made when they came in.
That's really interesting.
That's, I feel like in the commercial world, that's like a fine line that we're always trying to not cross, which is like, you know, a lot of times we'll get storyboards for the commercials that we're pitching on they'll be like, yeah, you didn't add anything. You just pitched us what we showed you. And you're like, well, isn't this what you wanted? And then other times they're like, we showed you what we wanted and you just pitched something totally different. Like,
you have to make
what's wrong with you? Yeah. So it's like, how do you take people's ideas and like, you know, plus them, like make them your own or add a little sweet sauce? And something we read about you was you were described in your work on Ginny and Georgia is that you were challenged with enhancing the story stylistically and visually while maintaining the tone that season one established.
Wow. Where did you read that? I don't even know.
You got great PR people, James.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
You know, especially as the first episode takes a dark turn.
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
Of the second season. So I'm curious, like, if you can be specific, like, how did you build on season one of Ginny and Georgia and stylistically change it? You know, we have a friend, a DP, that he shot the second and third season, Good Girls, and the first season, NBC loved it. Everyone loved it. They wanted to, you know, they brought it back, but then they also wanted to kind of go from a more kind of mainstream network look to a more like almost cinematic indie heist film, not indie, but cinematic like heist film look. And so that was one of his jobs, was to figure out what that means, you know, while still keeping it like a network show.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about, like, you know, was there a Bible? Were there some rules, some approaches, moves, things?
The Bible was the script and the whole first season that I watched, right? So I didn't have anything to do with the first season. It wasn't on my radar. I wasn't available for it. But I, like the tens of millions of people in the world that caught that show, caught it after the first season, and then I went after it. I saw the genius that those two the writers had done for that show, and I wanted to be involved.
And for our listeners that haven't seen the show, aren't familiar with the show, can you just give us like a quick log line?
Ginny and Georgia, it's a mother-daughter story that sort of jumps through genres on Netflix in the second season, about a daughter who discovers that her mom is a murderer. But it's also a YA teen drama and a murder mystery, and it touches a lot on issues of mental health.
And maybe a little screwball even? Like you say, jumps through genres. Like there are major tonal shifts where you're
That's what I thought when I first came across the project was so cool and interesting and new about it. It sort of has this like millennial irreverence to
it's like the Coen brothers doing Riverdale or something, right?
Which I thought was so cool. And the thing is that they had to convince the people. I mean, Netflix was so supportive of this project, and the cast is amazing as well, and so on side with them. But just think on a crew and camera people world, they really had to work hard to convince them that this was awesome, and sure enough the audiences proved it was right. So I just thought that was really cool. I love the way it dealt with diversity. I love the way it dealt with tough issues of mental health, and the jumping around genre thing was just really unique about it. So I came in second season. It was a Zoom meeting with Sarah and Deb, much like this. And to me, that's just a matter of saying what you love about the show, what you love, what you did with it. And then they brought me on. There was nothing new that we wanted to do with it. We just wanted to deliver the show as good, if not better, than what it had been before, right? There was lots to work with what they had discovered in the first season. They had gone through a lot of trouble to figure out what the voice of it was. Mm-hmm. And they'd worked with five other directors in the first season. So I just looked at it like, to answer your question, I just looked at it like, how do I ensure that this is the quality level of it is as great as it can be? And also to create a great environment for the cast and crew and take the stress away that what first seasons tend to have, right? And get us smoothly into giving them that space to do this again, which I think they really did.
You know, it's funny. I think about oftentimes a criticism I'll have of like a TV show is like, I'll say from a performance perspective, like these two people aren't in the same show. One person is doing something super heightened and somebody's doing something super grounded. And it's like, I don't know how to make heads or tails of this. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the recipe, right? Mm-hmm. For your show as a director. How do you dial that in for performers? And also, how do you gut check it? How do you know you're doing it right? You know what I mean? Because it's so fresh and so new, some of those old instincts aren't correct anymore.
Yeah. I don't know. This show is different from others. It's a very particular brainchild of Sarah and Deb. And the one thing that this benefits from is we would try versions of it. So there would be oftentimes there'd be experiments with how we're toning something as we go along the way. But me coming in the second season, the cast also knew that this was part of the voice of this show was that it was able to jump around. You know, it's Christmas episodes, and there was in the first season there were crazy Halloween episodes where there were little horror moments to it, right? So to me, the beauty of the show was in that it celebrates and loves diversity in its characters. The characters are flawed and weird and troubled, and they make crazy mistakes. And the show, it gives you this license to be off and change gears because it's not attempting to take itself so seriously and live in some so perfect world, right? It's kind of like, I think one of you said a little earlier about comedy and the difficulty of comedy versus drama, but you can set yourself free from these things when you're not sitting this world of, you have to be perfectly aligned to a tone or a voice that you've set up. This one just had this freedom to it, and the ingredients of it just worked so well for audiences. The reach of the show is incredible for that.
But on a take-by-take basis, are you saying, like, you're in a scene and you're like, okay, try this one screwball, ground this one, a little more YA. Are you shifting that hard in between different takes, or are you kind of have a better sense of what needs to be what on a scene basis?
Yeah, it's probably not as wide a thing as that, because the scene itself will determine that. Mm-hmm. So we would know, you know, what beat we're playing in this show.
The,
as you mentioned in that little blurb that you read that I've never seen that sounds awesome, is that the first episode was toned darker than the so we knew going in our discussions and prepping the show that it had to follow where the season one finale had left off, right? So that was my guide. And there was a great deal of work that went into how we were representing the mental health issues. So there's a ton of these really interesting scenes where a teenager is struggling with mental health, and we had a very clear guidance on how we were going to handle that, right? So there's all these things. You go into a scene, you know where you're sitting with it. And I had the advantage of knowing that in the first season, this cool mashup was really worked in an unusual, interesting, unique, and really new, fresh way. So you just sort of trust in that and let it go. I kind of recall there was this, the first scene we did of the show was a random episode two middle scene, right? Mm-hmm. And there was this sort of anticipation that morning of, oh, this show has really took off in the first season, and I hope we can repeat it. And there's a little bit of anxiousness about, does it work? Does it work? And then within take one or take two of that, the cast just falls into it, and they remember their place in it, and they remember how well it works, and they remember that the material comes alive so easily for them, right? That has to do to me with a great casting and the writing that matches the casting. It's just one of those weird things where this thing blows up.
Are you involved in the casting and all, like the day players or kind of new characters that are added for season two?
Absolutely. Yeah, all the new characters for season two. So obviously I wasn't around for season one in the main cast. But in the first episode of the second season, we cast the families of a couple of the characters and spent quite a bit of time with them. Throughout the season, I would deal with the casting for the main parts. And that was really fun. We had to cast the kids for the younger versions of the main characters. So we did a bunch of callbacks with little kids that came up a lot. But also for the episodic guest actors, the guest director for their episode would cast their own stuff, right? So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. So,
and are you casting a lot of Canadians since you're shooting in Canada?
In that show, yeah, the ones and twos and threes and fours are Americans, and Diesel is from Australia. And
can you tell us what you mean by ones and twos and threes? Are you talking about the people, the call sheet?
The call sheet numbers. Yeah. So the leads are American and a couple of Australians. And then a great deal of the cast is from Toronto or Canada. And that's the other thing that really attracted me in the project in the first place, too, because it was a ton of really great actors that I knew quite well from working with them in Toronto.
That's awesome.
Doing a show that's really...
Yeah, that's awesome. Great.
Yeah.
Since you're jumping between these different genres and stuff, are you pulling references? Are you like, oh, there was a sequence in Scream, or I love this, like,
yeah. You
know, and you're showing the DP that and things like that.
I mean, it doesn't matter what show it's on. I have a lot of fun finding references that people know. No matter what, everything we do has been done in some way or another. We can refer to it, right? Mm-hmm. Last week on Good Doc, we were doing a sequence and we were referencing things like Ferris Bueller's Day Off and so forth. And so it's so easy to communicate with people when you're able to, you know, draw on something that everybody knows so intuitively. So
do that shot of the whole gang walking down the hallway in slow motion and you tilt up from their shoes
Reservoir Dogs, yeah, for sure.
My last question was very much a selfish question. We talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but Matt and I are both married to actors. Should we just like move to Canada and try to become TV directors there and have our wives just be cast in everything? Because we are not that Canada is not competitive. I'm sure it's very competitive, and Toronto is basically seems like the TV capital of the world right now. But in terms of like directing talent and acting talent, like LA, you know, Hollywood is still Hollywood. It's where so many people are headquartered and where, you know, the best directors and the best actors in the world are here, and you're constantly competing against them. Is there
Is there some advantage in going to Canada, like you said, and maybe being more of like a medium fish in a medium pond as opposed to a small fish in a big pond?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm a Canadian and I built my career in Canada, and I'm so grateful for Canada to provide me for that, right? Like, Canada supports its creative people. It has a mandate to support its people because it has a giant pond next door full of a lot of fish that are going to eat all the food unless we help them out. I love the industry there. They look after us. Most of the time when people reach a certain point in their career, they're going to come to the United States and they're going to work here, right? A lot of times too, showrunners, writers, directors also then come back to Canada and they know that they have a certain... So sometimes there's a level of, you know, budgets, especially in television, there's a level of the people that you're going to work with that you reach there in Canada, and people want to branch out. But also there's a real beauty to just working in your hometown and telling Canadian stories. It's a little bit about representation, and there is differences between Canadian entertainment and American entertainment, and Canada wants to support that and celebrate that. And that's a really awesome thing, right? For people career building, they're always looking towards the United States and the industry down here to get to the next level. And that's obviously been my path in my career. Also, I will say that, especially lately, most produced shows that I'm on in Canada have some part in either the financing or there's some network influence from a US network. So they are
a co-production really, or something.
Yeah, it's a co-production of some kind, and their money is coming from there, and their broadcasting happens down here. And Canada has a ton of these. How I was able to get involved in bigger, better American projects is because they're shooting in Canada, and I was a director that happened to be there. It wasn't any cheaper for them. I was sometimes, obviously, you know, from a different city, but it just sort of puts you on the map a little more with people, with crews, producers that are working up there. It's funny because one of the DGA, the main production centers in North America are Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, and Vancouver, right? Two of them are from another country.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it does make me think about, you know, there's a lot of talk and, you know, potentially a strike on the writer's side about how Hollywood right now isn't especially, you know, friendly to early and mid-career writers in particular, but I think directors have a little bit of a challenge too, because it's episode orders are shorter, right? So if you're doing 8 episodes of a TV show, you know, that's way fewer, you know, directors that you're hiring, writers that are on staff, all of that stuff shrinks down. And so the ability to find a livelihood you can sustain for an entire year, or, you know, many years in this case, it's just it's harder and a different landscape than it used to be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, listeners at home, if you've got like an opportunity to build a career and kind of level up before you want to go out to, you know, a quote unquote bigger market, I'd count to 10 for sure. I'd enjoy some comedies in Canada for a minute for sure. Let the dust settle a little bit, you know.
Yeah, Toronto is like a very unique situation, because we're talking about, you know, shows like The Good Doctor, Charmed. I mean, these are
big mega shows,
budget
network shows,
American network shows that maybe are filming in Toronto. You know, Handmaid's Tale. Like, there's all these like giant successful shows that are filming there, and like you said, you know, if you have Tim Burton directing Wednesday, and let's say it's shooting in Canada, I don't know where it shot, but let's say it is, and they're like, Tim's got half the episodes and we got 4 other episodes open, you know, we would love to hire some local people, you know, for tax credit reasons or for saving money, or just, you know, to mix things up. And then again, like in terms of casting, like, you know, if you're okay with being number 5, 6, or 7 on the call sheet, you know, like our wives here who book, you know, they've both been on HBO shows and have done things, but every every single role they go up for, they're probably against like a famous person, you know, that lives in LA and would love to conveniently leave their house in the morning and shoot, you know, an episode of TV and get back to their family at night. So there is something about being in Canada where you're still accessing these same A-list American TV shows, but with just a lot less competition and a lot more snow.
The acting world is actually a great example of that, because there are some amazing careers that people have built as actors, especially in cities like Vancouver, where they can work very regularly doing, there's just such a steady stream of television that's done there, right? And they're up against less competition. It's a very good point. Directors,
I'm ready to move.
How much does a house cost in Toronto or Vancouver?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But you do have to be a Canadian citizen in order to get like the Canadian content tax credits and all that stuff, right?
Yeah. I feel like, honestly, in my trajectory, the tax credit issue and your residency thing was far more important when I was working in the Canadian system on shows that are Canadian, because of their budget levels, they need to be actually in a provincial jurisdiction. That's why my actual residency is Ontario. Lately, I've been shooting a lot in Vancouver, and something like The Good Doctor doesn't care about the tax credit. They're going to choose a director that's going to suit the show, right? And that's amazing. I'm grateful for that. So yes, you do have to be a resident, and you may just look at it more like is the small pond. You said this a little earlier. If you're from a smaller city and you're deciding, should I be moving to Los Angeles to build this career, then start by just looking in your backyard and what's
shooting there. Yeah.
Yeah, what you can climb up closer by. Before, I spent many years in my 20s when I was starting out making films, coming here to Los Angeles and knocking on doors and trying to get attention, and nobody would pay attention to a Canadian newbie, right? Whereas in Canada, I was able to build.
Yeah, I mean, it is the people we've talked to, like a Zach Lipovsky, who's been on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Who is now, you know, he started out doing Disney Channel shows because they needed Canadian directors.
Yeah.
And now he's doing Final Destination 6.
Is that right? I didn't see that. That's awesome. Congrats, Zach.
And then I had pitched this show. I was attached to direct this series with CW in the US. And it was like, we ended up getting it co-financed by CBC in Canada.
Yeah.
So I flew to Toronto. I pitched the show with everyone. And then when we got greenlit, it was like the budget was a little tight and they needed all the tax credits they could get. Yeah. And they're like, hey, Oren, you can't direct the show. We need a Canadian director because we already have American show creator, American writers. They basically were like, you're an EP and here's some money, go away. And that was the first time where I was like, oh, if I was Canadian, this would not have happened.
Like when I was starting out, I paid attention to directors' careers and how they manage this in Canada, because it's always our question when they leave their hometown. And there's all kinds of routes. There's Canadians or Americans that had dual citizenship or something and then chose to work in Canada, and they were able to accelerate their career. But your story there is a really sad story of sort of a reverse discrimination against someone because they weren't Canadian, and that's too bad. It's usually
turns out people don't like Americans after all.
No, we love you. Vancouver's full of American crews and cast and actors, and the majority of the above the line people there, the directors and the writers, are coming up from LA and working there and shooting their shows there. It's rare now. An interesting example is I started in Vancouver. I grew up there. I started making shorts and stuff in Vancouver. When I broke into comedy TV, I was looking at what was going on in Vancouver. It was things like Poltergeist and Outer Limits and TV shows like that, they were hiring Canadian directors, but there was this small echelon of maybe four or five really great directors that were repeatedly being used. And then the rest were coming up from the United States. So that just wasn't available to me. What was available was little shows that were coming out of Toronto, and very few of them shot in Vancouver. So I had to make a decision to leave my life behind and move to Toronto and change my residency. So I made those sacrifices. That's the side of the business that you guys maybe don't hear directors complain about too much, but you do. You make a ton of sacrifices for the job that you love, and put all that aside and move to different cities.
Yeah, I don't know that the show is light on complaining.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've never complained, but man, can't stand that guy. Yeah. I thought he was complaining. Just kidding. Well, James, thanks so much for coming and talking to us.
Hey.
And
yeah,
we're excited about Ginny and Georgia. And I mean, all your shows, obviously, you seems like, yeah, there's a
lot of stuff.
There's a lot to see from you. Is there, do you know what's next for you? Are you allowed to tell us anything interesting?
I guess like I'm doing a show that's actually a CBC and Paramount show that's going to shoot in Ontario and North Bay. And then I think I'm going to do a pilot that's probably, I can't really talk about quite yet, but that's really exciting.
Congrats.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Really,
and there are way more.
Can you tell us, is that Canadian for a Canadian broadcaster also?
The crazy thing is both those happen to be CBC in combination with something else. I'm not quite sure, but again, that's a great example of how it's working up there most of the time. They're hungry for ideas and the best quality and you know, talent. So they're doing what they have to do.
And both those shows, they've been written, they've been greenlit, and they attached you to come direct.
Yeah, well, the pilot is not secured yet, and it has to do with dates. And the whole thing in this job, of course, is the opportunity costs and what you're available for and not available for, and the decisions you make along the way. So I can't be certain that that's going to work out, but be nice.
And that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, fingers crossed, and let us know. Come on back when that pilot's in the can and a huge hit. And in the meantime, do you have a few more minutes to hang out and endorse with us?
Oh, yeah.
Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement this week is a little bit of a cheat because it's actually homework for an upcoming episode, an upcoming interview. We're having the creator and director of the show, Paul T. Goldman, coming soon. This director, Jason Walliner. And so Warren knows him, and he was like, oh, we'll have Jason on. Oh, this will be great. And I've been a longtime fan.
Like many of our great guests, I've met them at like preschool and daycare.
Preschool. Yeah. So he's got this show on Peacock called Paul T. Goldman that is really wild. You know, if you liked The Rehearsal or True Crime, it's really genre bending.
And you know, Jason directed a bunch of Nathan For You's, right?
Yes, I forgot that. Yes. So this show is about a guy who messaged Jason on Twitter with this crazy story about how his wife is involved in this crazy crime ring. And he's written a book about it. And then also the screenplay adaptation of the book. And he's pitched it to this creator, Jason, and he wants to make it a show. And so it's like partially the quote unquote movie that this man has written, partially documentary, like talking head, like Errol Morris style documentary, so like basically recreation and then the documentary and then also behind the scenes of the movie they're making. But as it evolves, the narrator, this character, Paul, this man, Paul, becomes less and less reliable, and you realize that he's fabricated a lot of this book and that maybe he's got his own agendas, and the director Jason kind of becomes a character in it as well, and you kind of don't know.
Are you caught up?
I'm not 100% caught up yet. But I'm so
there's
into
only
it.
One episode left.
I can't wait. I'm so into it. But it's like if Errol Morris and Nathan For You and Serial, maybe, or just like a little bit of like modern true crime, all kind of came together with a real dark sense of humor. It's pretty great. It's pretty wild. Paul T. Goldman on Peacock is crazy. It's a really weird show. James.
Yeah.
You got some new headphones today? Do you want to talk about those?
Orin and I have both endorsed headphones on the show before.
These are $6 best buy off the road there. Yeah.
There you go.
So far, they work fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. When people ask me what to read about it, I read about directing. I always talk about the book that William Friedkin did. Did you ever read his memoir? It's awesome.
No, tell us more.
Oh, well, he's a 70s Hollywood director, exorcist, sure. And yeah, you know, and he just has an awesome memoir. It's been years that I read it, but that's one that I often quote. I think it's just his name.
Oh, yeah, that's the Friedkin connection, the memoir.
The connection, yeah. And yeah, it's awesome. I loved it. Because he talks a lot, you don't get this a lot in director's memoirs. He writes a lot about the technique and the craft, but then he also talks about the real up and down swing that his career took and, you know, Hollywood's dark corners that he visited. So I love that one. When you're asking about it before, I was going to say, what am I going to pitch? And the only thing I can say is back to the CBC and my love for the CBC. There's a show I do with a bunch of friends in Nova Scotia called Moonshine that we're on the third season of it. I've only done like 4 episodes over 3 years, but it's this, we shoot it out on beaches in Nova Scotia. And it's, this friend of mine, Sherry Elwood, and basically a story of her family working on building a campground and the family battle that goes on in this resort campground in Nova Scotia.
Well, mine is not good.
Yeah,
it's literally like a TikToker. There's this guy. His name is Daniel LaBelle. I'm posting in the chat here a video of his. Called Chivalry Is Not Dead Part 3. I'm sure if you've like literally gone on TikTok or accidentally clicked on the stories section of like Facebook or something, you might have like come upon his videos. You know, they're mostly shot in vertical. But I don't know. It kind of reminds me of like Buster Keaton or something. You know, like he's just this guy and he has this video, the one that I'm talking about, where when his wife texts him when he gets home and he's like running around the house just to make he's like the house husband and she's off at work. And when she comes home, he's just trying to make her life easy by like opening all the doors for her, you know, like helping like microwave things. And it's just this perfectly choreographed video of him running all over the place. This other one he did is so dumb.
I've seen this one actually. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like it's footage of him running with a cameraman shooting him.
Yeah.
Also running. And it just reminds me of like just how we all started filmmaking.
Yeah.
Holding a camera, chasing our friends down the street, you know, jumping through windows, just doing the dumbest things. Like,
yeah, it's awesome.
There's no storytelling. It's just 100% pure action. Well, if people want to learn more about you, James, do you tweet? Are you on Instagram? Is there a place?
I have a website with my info on it, I guess. But
what is it? JamesGen.com?
Yeah, jamesgen.com.
jamesgen.com.
That's right. You guys are awesome. I'm going to say once more, I think it's awesome what you're doing and spending your time and donating your weekday evenings to support other directors.
If you have questions for us, you can tweet at us at justshootitpod, email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com, and you can follow us across all social media at justshootitpod. I'm at Mr. Matt Edmo.
And I'm on Instagram at O'Kaplan. On Twitter, I'm at Smitey Pyleg. And I'm putting more stuff on Instagram, so check it out. Rate us on iTunes if you get a chance. Our editor is Noah Bayshore. Our producer is Tyler Small. And you're listening to music from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And we will catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.